Firstly, I'll just explain to you briefly where the Sadducees come from, because we often hear the stories of the Pharisees, or stories involving Pharisees, but not so much the Sadducees. Luke is the only one that mentions the Sadducees, and they're mentioned today in that Gospel, and they'll also be mentioned in his second book, The Acts of the Apostles. When Israel came back from its exile, there was no king, no solitary leader. And the leaders of the people became the priestly caste. So the priests stepped up a notch and they became the nobility of the people, of the Jewish people. And they held and wielded a lot of power. The backbone of this teaching, or the life of the Sadducees, was the first five books of what we call the Old Testament, so the Torah. The first five books of Moses. The Pharisees, on the other hand, come much later. And by the time the book of Maccabees was written, which was about 130, 180 years before Christ was born, and you hear that account of the seven brothers and the mother dying today, by the time that was written, the understanding of resurrection was well and truly in place. However, the Pharisees believed in the resurrection and the Sadducees did not. They took only the teachings of the first five books of Moses. So resurrection doesn't get mentioned under that word. The Pharisees, however, did, as I say, believe in the resurrection. And this is one of the rare times where Jesus actually sides with the Pharisees. And then you get that famous story in the Gospel where the Sadducees put this corny question to Jesus. Now, I should explain that from the first five books of the Old Testament, the law states that when a man marries a woman, and normally, as I have explained before, in the culture of the Jewish people at that time, the ideal was to marry as close to your initial family as possible, to keep the family tight. So normally they would be marrying first cousins. I know it sounds yuck, but just bear with us. So that was the custom. So therefore the law stated that the brother of the deceased would then marry the widow if she had no child, because the whole purpose of marriage and the conjugation was to have children to promote the family life. So it was the welfare and the status of the family that was so important. It drove who could marry who. That's how critical it was in those times. Thank heavens that's not the case today, eh? So the Sadducees, using the law of the Old Testament, apply that in what we call in absurdum. They make up this ridiculous hypothesis and they give it to Jesus for him to solve. It's a little bit like, I remember being when I was in the seminary, and a professor, and I've told you this before, I know, this professor said to us in a class, if a rat broke into the church and then broke into the tabernacle and ate the Blessed Sacrament, did the rat eat the body of Jesus? Mr. Thompson, I remember him saying. I said, well, Professor, that would depend whether the rat was baptised or not. Get out of my class. Wasn't the first and it wasn't the last time. It is a ridiculous thing to even discuss, really. And that's what the Sadducees were trying to do. And Jesus very cleverly took the old law, as it were, and then applied it to the understanding of the resurrection, which was very much a part of the conversation of the day, though the Sadducees rejected it. Now, the idea of the resurrection, and even in our Christian understanding, it is always a debate. It is not something that is just cut and dried. It is always a debate, but it's a theological debate and part of our faith. So when we start even to describe what is our faith, everybody here will have a different interpretation and a different way of living out their faith. When it comes to understanding the resurrection, it probably depends on what is our understanding of heaven, or what is our understanding of what happens to us once we die. Now, for a Christian, we believe that we return to God. Not go to God, but we return to God from where we came. If you're not a Christian, well, I guess your GPS is going somewhere else. But for Christians, we are returning to our Creator. How that happens is, once again, a theological debate. What does it look like? Do we get there? How do we know we've arrived? What is your perception of afterlife or of heaven? Now, you can explain it to children, particularly around the time of a death, in terms of when you look up into the sky and you'll see a star. All of those things are helpful for children. They're less helpful for adults because they actually blur or cloud, excuse the pun, the reality of what heaven is for a Christian. It is a state. That's why Jesus uses the term angels. We know that angels do not have a physical presence. They are a spiritual being. And so he says you are children of God, like the angels. So that's helpful when understanding what happens to us at the end of our life. We don't have to think about the poor chaps who had their legs blown off in Afghanistan in the horrors of this recent war, that when they and then they die, and when they get to heaven, they're all up there without their legs. That's rubbish. We are spirit returning to the greater spirit, if you like. And so to use images of humanity, or humankind rather, is very misleading, because the next thing we start saying, oh, is God has hands and he has fingers and he has feet to kick the naughty ones, and God is pure spirit. The better image to relate what happens to us at the end of our life when we return to God is really to talk about things like the feelings or light and darkness. The best image, I think, is that when we die and we return to God, we are with God. So how do I define hell in that sense? That is not being able to be with God. Where is that? Don't get too carried away with what artists have done over the years with poking marshmallows and hot fires and things. It is being withdrawn from the absolute and pure beauty and joy and bliss, if you like, of being in the presence of God the Creator. It is so magnificent that we really can't define it. Once again, a theological debate, if you like. But it is much healthier than trying to contain God in a bodily image and trying to contain the dead in the same way that the living live. Because that's what the Sadducees were doing, or trying to do, with their silly question. Because the way that we live our life as we are, with what we've got and who we are, is not what's going to be, is not who we're going to be when we return to our Creator. So marriage is for the procreation of mankind. That doesn't matter. There is no procreation because there's no death at the end of our life. So the whole idea of marriage is gone. It's history. The whole idea of relationship, other than the being in the presence of God Almighty, is alive and active. It's very difficult for us because our every waking moment, and quite often even the nightmares in our sleep, are things that relate to the behaviour that we put up with or we create in the here and now with all we are as a person. You take away all we are as our understanding as a person, and then you're left wondering what it is. Who are we? Where do we end up? What actually happens to us? If we are created in love and God is pure love, as the readings say, he cannot go against what he has promised. He is faithful and he cannot do anything in the negative. That is impossible for God, which should be reassuring for us who are living our life now suspended between earth and heaven. We're suspended between time and eternity. We're suspended, in a sense, between nothingness and infinity. Now, they might seem like theological arguments again. Well, they are, in a sense, but when you think of the opposites that make us what we are and who we are to become, that is the story of our life. And death is only part of the story, because our God, our Creator, is God of the living, not of the dead. To God, all people are living.